Thank you. First of all, thank you very much. I want to thank all of you for having me here. I'm grateful to be here. I'm glad to hear that that speech a few years ago served as an inspiration to even expand this business. And as I was just expressing a moment ago, my commission check, I guess, is on the way. I don't know. So I'm kidding. Chris, thank you as well for being here. The Club for Growth is one of the finest organizations involved in American politics. They go out and they find people that are committed to free enterprise and limited government. And in particular, they do a good job of finding the people that say they are, but really aren't in their actions. I can just tell you there were a lot of people that were instrumental. Many of you are here today that were instrumental in making that victory possible against the sitting governor of Florida. I was at 3% in the polls. At the very beginning of that race, the only people that thought I could win, they all lived in my house. And four of them were under the age of 10. So when the Club for Growth came on board, they didn't just endorse me. They helped raise money for me from their members all across the country. Chris was instrumental in that. There is no way I would be in the U.S. Senate were it not for their help. I'm always grateful, and I'm honored to have his support now, not just because of his stance on the issues, but because he's a Florida resident, which means he can vote for me, too. So we're grateful to him for that. And I want to thank all of you for being here. And, you know, every time that an election rolls around, the media becomes obsessed with polls. But oftentimes, I think they obsess about the wrong ones. Today, I want to talk to you about a poll the media is ignoring. But I wish they had been talking about the entire campaign. There's this recent poll, and it asked, this is the question that it asked, is the American dream dead or alive? Almost half of the millennials, meaning younger Americans, their answer was that the American dream was dead. Other polls have shown even higher numbers across every generation. So this is a warning sign for America, a sign that what's at stake in this election is our identity as a special nation. That identity has long been tied to the belief that here, anything is possible. That here, that you don't have to come from wealth and you don't have to come from privilege to provide a comfortable life for your family. Here in America, anyone who works hard can leave their children better off than themselves. This is the real American dream. But today, it is dying. It's not dying because our people have changed. They haven't. It's dying because both parties in Washington, quite frankly, both parties, have let us down. It's dying because our current president, Barack Obama, has abandoned the economic principles that made us the most prosperous nation in the world. It's dying because Congress has spent us into an unprecedented debt. And it's dying because while our economy is pushing the boundaries of the 21st century, way too many of our leaders are still stuck in the 20th century. They fail to grasp the way that technology and globalization have transformed our economy. They raise taxes and they grow government, even though it's costing jobs and it's making America globally uncompetitive. They shrug off the rising importance of trade and foreign policy on our household budgets. They seem bewildered when market turmoil in Beijing ends up triggering market turmoil in New York. To confront these new realities, what we need are new leaders. Leaders who will apply the free market principles of our founding to the economic realities of our time. Who will once again place Washington's faith in our economy rather than forcing our economy to place its faith on Washington. The purpose of my presidency will be, when it comes to economics, the purpose of my presidency will be to restore the American dream. And I'm going to start by re-embracing free enterprise, because it is the greatest economic system in history. It's the only system where poor people can become richer without making rich people poorer. The only system where everybody can be better off. Here's what Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton don't understand about free enterprise. In the free enterprise system, the president does not run the economy. The president's job is to ensure policies are in place that allow the private sector to succeed, because it is the private sector that creates jobs and opportunity. Today, we don't have those policies in place. Under Barack Obama, Washington borrows an average of more than $1 trillion a year. It forces our private sector to spend almost $2 trillion a year just to comply with federal regulations. It imposes the highest highest corporate tax rate in the developed world. It thinks its job is to make your healthcare decisions, to bail out big businesses, and even to try to control the weather. As our president, I will put Washington in its place. It will once again stand behind our people, not in their way. When I am president of the United States, I will repeal and replace Obamacare before it repeals and replaces any more jobs. When I am president of the United States, I will shred every single one of Barack Obama's job-killing executive orders. When I am president, I will cap the amount regulations can cost our economy, and I will end Washington's addiction to wasteful spending. Because by the time our next president takes office, America, our country, will already be $20 trillion in debt. It's difficult to even fathom how much that is. So think about it this way. If you were to count $20 trillion by hand at $1 per second without stopping, it wouldn't take a year or a decade or even a century to finish counting. You know how much it would take you to count to a trillion, to count to that $20 trillion with your hands? It would take over 600,000 years. That's how much money we will owe when Barack Obama leaves the White House. The debt will have almost doubled since he took office. Much of that money we owe to China. And make no mistake, if we change nothing, we are going to have a debt crisis in this country. It is going to destroy jobs. It is going to disrupt the function of government. And it is going to threaten our national security. This is the most predictable crisis in American history. But every time the alarm starts blaring, signaling that we reached the debt ceiling, Washington hits the snooze button and goes back to sleep. Under our last three presidents, the debt ceiling has been raised more than 20 times without a single serious spending reform. I will stop this irresponsible spending, and I will, as your president, solve this nation's debt crisis once and for all. First, as your president, I will have the political courage, to reform the main drivers of our debt, which is the way Social Security and Medicare are structured for future generations, like mine and my children. If we do nothing to save these important programs, they will bankrupt themselves, and then they will bankrupt our country. I will save them for future generations by placing them on a fiscally sustainable path. But that alone is not going to avert a debt crisis, because history backs up the following fact. If you do not have laws in place to keep politicians from spending money they don't have, they will borrow money and they will spend it. It doesn't matter what party you put in charge. And since Congress refuses to pass a law restricting itself from spending money it doesn't have, we truly are left with only one option. We must do what the founders of this great nation gave us the power to do. We must call a convention of states to amend the U.S. Constitution. It will be limited. They won't be able to touch the First Amendment. They won't be able to touch the Second Amendment. They won't be able to touch our important constitutional rights. But here's what we need them to do. We must pass amendments limiting the size and scope of the federal government. Amendments that force Congress to pass a balanced budget by passing a balanced budget amendment. And my favorite, amendments to oppose term limits on Congress and the courts. I like the balanced budget amendment too, but term limits are my favorite. As president, I will be able to promote such a convention, but I cannot make it happen. The American people have to make it happen. And that's why I'm asking for your help today. To any American worried about the debt we're leaving our children, join this effort. Join me in this effort. press your state representatives and state senators to convene a convention of states so we can pass a balanced budget amendment and we can pass term limits in this country once and for all. The third step we have to take to solve our debt crisis is growing the American economy. That will happen by making America the best place in the world to own and to operate a business. If you want to know how to do this, talk to job creators. Talk to the people who are doing it. I don't know a single job creator in America who is asking for more taxes or more regulations. Yet that's exactly what some candidates for president are proposing. If you listen to Hillary Clinton, every answer to every problem she has is to raise taxes and create a new government program. And it's not just her or the avowed socialist running against her. Believe it or not, multiple Republican candidates for president support new taxes on the American people. Some even support something, a new tax that generations of conservatives have fought against. It's called a value-added tax, also known as a VAT. The VAT is being proposed in this election. Here's how it works. It works by taxing businesses at each stage of the production process. It falls squarely on profits and on wages. What it means is companies will have to pay taxes on the money they make, but they will also have to pay taxes on the money they pay their employees. And that means it punishes businesses for earning money, and it punishes your employer for giving you a raise. The VAT is also intentionally sneaky. It attempts to trick people into believing their taxes are being lowered when in fact and in reality, they are simply being shifted to employers, meaning everyday Americans would feel its impact through higher prices and lower wages. If you start making businesses pay a new tax on the money they pay their employees, they will have to pass that through lower pay and higher prices on their customers. And this is going to be especially harmful to the poor and to senior citizens living on a fixed income. Because while they're not earning income, they're paying taxes on, they're spending money. And everything will cost more because we've now shifted the tax burden, double the tax burden, to the employer. The VAT makes for a dangerous expansion of Washington's power, especially when you realize it is being added on in addition to the continued existence of the income tax. In most European countries where a VAT has been implemented, government has grown in its size. It is no wonder that the fans of the VAT include Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama, who called it a novel idea. And opponents include Ronald Reagan, who said that the value-added tax, and this is a quote from Ronald Reagan, gives a government a chance to blindfold the people and grow in stature and size. And he was right. No candidate who supports this tax can claim to be in favor of abolishing the IRS. Reagan's Treasury Department estimated that they would need 20,000 new agents to administer a new value-added tax. Republican candidates today try to hide their support for the value-added tax by renaming it a business flat tax. But don't be fooled. If it acts like a VAT, and it taxes like a VAT, and it grows government like a VAT, it's a VAT. This isn't the only anti-free market idea being offered up by Republicans in this race. There are other Republicans running for president who support an internet sales tax that could subject businesses to being audited by almost 10,000 separate jurisdictions around the country who impose sales taxes. The internet is the marketplace of the 21st century, and it is unacceptable that anyone who claims to be a conservative would join this liberal cause for an internet tax. Let me be clear. I do not support new taxes of any kind, because what our country needs is economic growth, and there is no new tax that leads to economic growth. So what I have offered instead is a plan that simplifies and reduces taxes on both individuals and on businesses. My plan is pro-growth and pro-family. It will lower the corporate tax rate to be globally competitive. It will level the playing field between big business and small ones. And it will make it easier for your employer, for your boss, to give you a raise. It will also allow families, working families, to keep more of their own money, of the money they earn. Today, it is more expensive than ever to raise a child. And our tax system is making it even costlier. With four children of our own, Jeanette and I know firsthand and live this every day in our home. As president, that's why I want to raise the per-child tax credit, because that money belongs to the parents. So they can keep more of their own money to spend on things like food and clothing and school supplies and all the other daily costs associated with raising children, especially in the 21st century. I'm also going to end the marriage penalty, a marriage penalty that leads couples being taxed more than individuals. Nothing has the ability to improve a child's future more than being raised in a loving two-parent home, and it is time our tax code recognizes it. Through tax reforms, I'm also going to strengthen family leave policy, so fewer parents have to choose between providing financially for their children or being there for them in a time of crisis. So fewer families and people have to choose between suffering financially because they have some time off of work to care for an ailing parent. But instead of raising taxes and growing government to solve this problem, as Hillary Clinton and others proposed last week, I'm going to solve it by cutting taxes for all businesses that offer between 4 and 12 weeks of paid leave, to make it more affordable without more government. From the individual to the business side, my free market reforms will make it easier. It will lead to a tax code that will make it easier for Americans to find jobs and easier for our businesses to create them. They will help everyone succeed, and it will create not just millions of new jobs, but millions of better paying jobs. As president, I will recognize that what makes America great is not that we have rich people. We are grateful for financial success in this country. We should celebrate it, and I do. But every country has rich people. What makes America great is that here we have millions of people who are not necessarily rich, unless they win Powerball. They're not necessarily rich, but they have a job that pays a comfortable wage, that helps them and enables them to do the activities that they love with the people that they love, that allows them to retire with dignity, and that ultimately allows them to leave their children with even a better life than their own. That has been made possible in America because of the choices generations before us made. Almost every other country in the world has chosen to have the government dominate their economy. And so in those countries, those who can influence government, they keep winning, and everybody else stays the same. The employee in those countries never becomes the employer. The small business can never compete with the big business. And no matter how hard your parents work or how many sacrifices they make, if you weren't born into the right family in those countries, there was only so far you can go. But Americans that came before us chose something very different. They chose individual liberty. They chose a limited government that exists to protect our rights, not to grant them. They chose a free enterprise system designed to provide equality of opportunity, not to force or to compel equality of results. And yet, despite the extraordinary story and success of America, there are still these people in our politics that cling to the belief that America is better off adopting the economic policies of nations who people leave to come here from. There have always been these voices in American politics. But unfortunately, 7 years ago, one of them was elected president. And since his election, he has sent the message to our people that becoming better off means someone else has to be worse off. That the only way to climb up the economic ladder is to give him or government the power to pull someone else down. That government is the best hope for those in search of a better life. But these government, big government ideas did what they have always done. They have failed. Our people hear him talk about how the economy is doing so great. but they sure don't feel it in their lives. And as a result, we are now at risk of seeing an entire generation of Americans, an entire generation, lose hope in the fundamental promise of our country. The promise that hard work and perseverance can and will lead to a better life. Seven years after Barack Obama have left us, sadly, a great nation in decline. But we can still pull ourselves out of this dive. Because, my friends, we are not a weak country. And we are not a weak people. We just have a weak president. And this year, we're going to change that. Thank you. This is no time for patience. The time to act on this is now. If we get this election wrong, there may be no turning back for America. That's why we can't afford to elect Hillary Clinton, because America cannot afford another 4 years like the last 7 years. This is also why we can't just elect any Republican. Because at its core, this election is not just a choice between two political parties. At its core, this election is a generational choice, a referendum on our identity as a nation and our identity as a people. We did not become this great country by accident. For over two centuries in our history, each generation before us, they did what they needed to do. They confronted their challenges. And because they did, they made it the greatest nation on earth. Now the time has come for this generation to do its part. Now the time has come for us to do our part. If you elect me president, the United States of America will return and re-embrace the principles that made America great. We will put the false promise of big government behind us, and we will once again re-embrace the power of a free people and a free country to create a more prosperous nation. And if we do this, we won't just save the American dream. We are going to expand it to reach more people and change more lives than ever before. We won't just have new jobs. We'll have jobs that pay more. We won't just have new businesses. We'll have new businesses that grow faster and create more opportunity, both for the people that own them and the people that work there. If we do what needs to be done in this generation, then this 21st century will not just be as good as the 20th century. It will be better. And history will say that this generation was the author of the greatest chapter in the amazing story of America, what will forever be known as a new American century. So thank you for hearing me out. Thank you. Thank you. So we have a few minutes. This is a big crowd, and I'm grateful that you're here. We have a few minutes for some questions. As is typical at this time in the campaign, I am traveling extensively, so at some point I'll have to leave, but we do have time for some questions. This gentleman here has a microphone. Is there another one, or is it just you? And this gentleman here, if you'll find them, please, if you'll just use the microphones, because that way everyone can hear what the question was. This lady here is also ready. She was ready, quick. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to commend you for admitting that your proposal to change to amend the Constitution is something that's not with the power of the president. But many of the things that you said you'd like to do that drew a lot of applause lines here involve powers that are constitutionally given to Congress. And I've been disappointed in the past with people who made promises, and when they got to Washington, they were either unable or unwilling to work with Congress to enact the policies. So if I agree with your policies, how can you ensure me that when you get to Washington as president, you'll be able to work with the Congress and convince them to enact these laws? And quite frankly, you know, I feel like maybe you've given up doing it as a senator, so how can you do it as president?
Well, let me touch a couple points that you just raised there. You've raised three that are important. Number one is, as president, I'm not doing anything that's unconstitutional. No matter how I believe in an idea, I'm not going to do it by executive order, and I'm not going to govern by decree the way this president does. Number two, not only have I not given up being a senator, I've actually done things, despite the fact that four of the last 5 years that I've been there, Democrats have run the place. For example, we brought some accountability, not nearly enough, but some accountability to the VA, because up until 2014, if someone at the VA wasn't doing their job, they couldn't be fired. I passed a law that gave the VA secretary the power to fire executives that weren't doing their job. Everyone running for president says, on the Republican side, says they're against Obamacare. I'm the only one running for president that's ever done anything meaningful about Obamacare. And I'll tell you what it was. In 2009, when they passed Obamacare, the big insurance companies got Barack Obama, Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi to create a bailout fund for them. And you know who pays for the bailout fund? You do. Well, last year, I wiped out the bailout fund. And I saved the taxpayers $2 billion. And some of the newspapers wrote that what Marco Rubio did is going to lead to the collapse of Obamacare. I hope so. But whether it does or it doesn't, when I'm president, Obamacare's gone, and we're going to put you back in charge of health care. That said, I have a history of working with people across the aisle if they want to fix something. For example, last week, I was able to get additional sanctions imposed on Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization. And the president even signed it, believe it or not. And that was bipartisan. My co-sponsor was a Democratic senator from New Hampshire. But here's the truth. Two things that are very true. Number one is, a senator can help shape the agenda, but only a president can change the agenda. You cannot undo the damage Barack Obama has done to this country as president if we do not have a president that will undo the damage and do the opposite of everything he's done to hurt this country. When I'm president, I will. And that's why I chose to run for president. And one last point on this constitutional, on the Convention of the States, that's not my idea. That is Article 5 of the Constitution. It was put there by the founders and the framers because they wanted to ensure that if things got out of hand, you, the people, had the power to take control of the federal government. I think things are out of hand. Oh, yes.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for your ideas. A couple of things I wish you had brought up or bring up in the future. One, I believe you're the only Republican candidate who can win the election in terms of where you are. With our foreign problems, I wish you would emphasize a new professional diplomacy, in which there is a West Point, a Naval Academy, an Air Force Academy, and a diplomatic academy, and commit to professionalism in diplomacy, all professionals. Another thing I wish you would emphasize is better management of resources, and get into ways that a huge, complex organization can be run. Thank you.
Well, let me address the three points in reverse. On the management, one of the best ways to address this large, complex organizations is to ensure they're not that large and not that complex. The federal government's too big. It should never have been this big. For example, we don't need a federal Department of Education. The important programs there can be given to Treasury. We don't need a national school board. Okay. On the second issue of diplomats, most of them are professional. They're foreign service officers. Obviously, there's always some political appointees. I think the key is to pick the right people, which leads me to your first point. And that is, not only do you believe that I can win this election, so does Hillary Clinton. That's why she attacks me every day. Let me be clear. I can't wait to run against Hillary Clinton, number one. Because we will beat her. Number two, Hillary Clinton is disqualified from being president of the United States. She handled classified information irresponsibly, and she lied to the families of those four victims of Benghazi. And she was a terrible Secretary of State. So she's disqualified from being president, and I can't wait to run a campaign reminding people of that.
I can't wait for you to run against her and whip her. My concern is, please do away with Obamacare. The insurance that I was paying as a self-employed person went from $400, the very same policy, went to $750. I don't know why. Please do away with that. Also, is there anything you can do about this atrocity that's happening with letting everybody out of Gitmo?
Yeah, well, those are two separate issues, and they're both important. I'm glad you raised them. Number one, Hillary Clinton said at the last Democratic debate that what you're going through is a glitch in the law. Not if it happened to you, not if it happened to millions of people across this country. And the reason why it's happening is straightforward. There's nothing free. If you make one thing cheaper, you got to make it up somewhere else. And the way they're making it up is the people that are not on Obamacare exchanges. People that had their insurance and they were happy with have lost it. You should be allowed to control your own health care money, no matter where it came from, your employer, a refundable tax credit, and you should be allowed to use it to buy any insurance you want across state lines. When I'm president, you will. And as far as Gitmo is concerned, number one, we're keeping it. We're not giving it back to Cuba. Number two, we're going to have a real war on terror when I'm president, which means this. This is what it means. The best intelligence agencies in the world are going to tell us where the terrorists are. The strongest military in the world is going to destroy those terrorists. And if we capture them alive, they're not going to get a court-appointed lawyer. They're not going to be read their Miranda rights. They're going to get a one-way ticket to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Sir, this is the second to last question.
As an engineer at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab for 33 years, a dear friend of mine was involved in the look for a practical alternative fuel back in the 70s and 80s. Two presidents, Republican, responded directly and correctly to that. The Alternative Motor Fuel Act of 1988, as President Reagan said, made it possible to take advantage of the huge availability of our natural gas and coal to make methanol, which happens to be the lowest carbon fuel on the planet Earth, and it happens to carry, per gallon, the highest amount of hydrogen, clean burning fuel, of any fuel. It's going for $1.05 right now in the markets, and ethanol that we are mandated to buy is going for $1.65 a gallon on the commodity markets. My suggestion is, could we use this open fuel standards? The gentleman who first initiated that in Congress in 2011 happened to be a colleague of mine from Johns Hopkins who somehow ended up in Congress for 20 years. He's one of the producers. My question is, all we're asking for is no mandates, no subsidies, let methanol happen. Just as a footnote, if you look across the Gulf of Mexico, this fall you will see 1,100-foot tankers taking methanol generated from our natural gas in Louisiana, going to China. They are going to consume 20 billion gallons a day of methanol produced in four states in the United States. God bless them. How about some for us? Let our market fight.
So I want America to be a world leader in every single energy resource, and that revolves removing all these artificial market barriers and allowing them all to compete in a free market. Let's do them all. Let's do biofuels, let's do renewables, let's do wind, let's do solar, let's do all of them. The only thing I've said is, we are out of our minds if we don't fully utilize the oil and the natural gas that God has blessed America with, and we will do that as well.
Sir, this will be your last question. Marco, good afternoon. Marco, when you're elected president of the United States, where will your first foreign trip be as president and why?
Israel. And I'll tell you why. Because the damage this president has done to our relationship with Israel is extensive. Number one, this president entered office with this promise that he was going to improve America's relations with the Islamic world, which in and of itself is not a wrong goal to have, but not at the expense of our relationship with Israel. And they went in with the thinking that the reason why we had a bad relationship with the Islamic world was because we were too close to Israel. And so we needed to create some distance in order to help our chances of being better off with the other nations in the region. And that's not what you do to an ally. There is only one pro-American free enterprise democracy in the entire Middle East, and that is the state of Israel. And so my first trip will be there so the world will know that we remain committed. By the way, today there is a report. I haven't read all of her emails, but there is a report today in the, I believe, the Free Beacon, Washington Free Beacon, I believe it's called. And it cites an email from Hillary Clinton staffers, one of her senior people to Hillary Clinton. And here's what the email says. We should come up with a clandestine covert program to stir up protests in the Palestinian areas, to force Israel to the negotiating table. This is what we are dealing with here. This is, let me tell you something else that's happened, sort of related to Israel on this issue of war on radical Islamists. There was a terrorist attack in Philadelphia last week. A police officer was shot 3 times. This brave police officer was able to recover, apprehend the individual, and we pray for him and for his family that they make a quick recovery. When they caught this person, they asked him, "Why did you do this?" This person did not resist. This person said, "I did it because I have pledged allegiance to ISIS. I am inspired by ISIS." To his credit, the police chief of Philadelphia said, "This person did it because of ISIS." The mayor of Philadelphia, who I know nothing about other than the fact that he's delusional, said, "This has nothing to do with ISIS or Islam. This is because there are too many guns in the street. This is because there are too many terrorists in the street." To date, as far as I know, as of 1:30 this afternoon, the White House has yet to say there was a terrorist attack in Philadelphia. They refuse to utter the word radical Islamic terrorist, and they refuse to take this issue seriously for what it is. Let me tell you guys something. These people we are dealing with are dangerous. They are not going away on their own. Either they win or we win. When I am president, we will win. Thank you very much for having me. God bless you. Thank you.